Was there a tendency to support their own Quaker families? For example, Odlums, who were Quakers. Now, did Flower came from?
I think. I've no direct evidence of that, but I presume that would have been the case. Well, certainly, yes, you're right, because I'm just thinking now. Shackleton's Mill in Lucan in Dublin, and they were Quaker firm. They provided flour for them. And in fact, that comes into the story in a very dramatic way, because in 1913, 100 years ago this year, the lockout in Jacobs was sparked by what happened in their suppliers, Shackleton's. Shackleton Mill in Lucan, they locked out their workers because they refused to leave Jim Larkin's union. And when the first, they got wind of this in Jacobs. And when the first sackload of flour came from Shackleton's mill to Jacobs, the men refused to handle it. And that sparked the whole lockout and strike in Jacobs then. It just grew from that, you know.
And why did they refuse to handle it? Was that just...
Oh, just in sympathy. In sympathy with the workers in, who had been locked out in Shackleton's, you know.
I see.
Just the idea of the sympathetic strike, you know.
To talk about the lockout period, was there... Jacobs, because they were employing so many people, they would have had unions.
Oh, yeah, got big tension in Jacobs during 1913.
Yeah, can you talk to me about that?
Yeah, a little bit now. Again, it's research I've done some time ago. I haven't revised it since. But as I say, it was sparked by the refusal of the workers in Jacobs to handle Shackleton flour. Mm-hmm. Now, and then the Jacobs management went like all the other management concerns, most of them in Dublin, and they said to the workers, look, we want you to sign this pledge that all the employees have to sign in all the big firms in Dublin, that you will leave Jim Larkin's union. If you don't, your job is gone, you know. Now, some of them did and some of them didn't. So there was a lot of tension among the workers between those who did and those who didn't. You know, you can understand that area of Dublin, poor area, on the edge fringes of Dublin's liberties, there wasn't much employment in the mid-19th century, early 20th century, into the 20th century. That area was a very deprived area. So you had these wage packets coming into these very small tenement homes, you know, for generations. Very difficult to get a young girl, maybe, you know, 16-year-old, 17-year-old girl, to sign a document and, you know, or to stick with Jim Larkin's union, you know, for her principles, to expect her to be locked out or go on strike and have nothing coming in. I mean, Jim Larkin's union hadn't much strike pay to pay anyone, you know. So a lot of them signed the document and said they wouldn't join Larkin's union or they would give up membership. But, of course, a lot didn't. So you had this community torn between, you know, those who did and those who didn't. And, for instance, some of the poor girls going into work would sign the document, being attacked by the workers who refused to go in, you know. And a lot of skirmishes up and down Bishop Street, you know, between workers. A couple of people jailed, actually, a couple of young girls jailed over it, you know. And that led to a couple of very important court cases as well, you know. So it was a fraught period, not just management worker, but worker thing that lasted for generations, because even when the strike collapsed, most, as far as I understand, certainly some of them, if not most of them, who were out and locked, never got their jobs back, you know. So it caused a lot of long term angst, you know, among workers.
So not long after 1913, you had the rebellion in 1916. And so what was happening in Jacobs at that time?
Yeah, well, in actual fact, Morris, they suffered three kind of blows that could have been devastating and weren't actually as bad as they could have been. Number one, the whole place went on fire in the late 1880s. And they completely rebuilt, and most of the place went on fire. But they rebuilt, and it meant then that their premises were state of the art, you know. So in a way, it was kind of a blessing in disguise, and they weren't insured, you know. So number two, 1913, and that did have a lot, they lost a lot of good name over that. Jacobs took a very hard line, despite being Quakers, you know, didn't interfere with their sort of hard line stance in 1913, you know. And they were heavily involved in the Employers Association, you know, so they took a very hard line. And then, during 1916, they were occupied by the rebels. I mean, it was a big, strong building, dominating sort of Redmond's Hill there, Ainger Street, Camden Street, leading from, say, Portobello Barracks there, which is a big British Army barracks. So I think the idea was to control that artery in and out of the city, you know. So Thomas McDonough was largely in charge of the rebels who occupied Jacobs. Now, there's a wonderful account written by the caretaker of Jacobs. It's in the Jacobs archives, handwritten account. Obviously, he was asked by management to write what of his experiences of what happened during 1916. It's in the book. And I can't remember his name now offhand, but he was held captive for Easter week. And he's a wonderful account. I mean, a couple of things shine through. But both were totally bored, because nothing, they saw no action, really. It was one of the few places that wasn't frontally attacked by anyone, you know. So they were kind of a bit isolated. You know, they didn't really know very much what was going on in the rest of the city, and they didn't suffer any direct attack, you know. A couple of interesting things. I mean, he says, the caretaker, he says that the spirits was very high among the rebels. And rumours would fly around, you know. The Germans had landed, for instance. That was a big rumour. The Germans were on their way. They'd landed in Ireland to help the rebels. And they were sure of it. That the whole country had risen, you know. And they were sure of it. And it was quite complimentary, actually, about them. They didn't touch any machinery. You know, they were very careful about the machinery. McDonough gave orders that they weren't to touch anything. They noticed that a short distance away, a street or two away, or maybe it was the caretaker who alarmed them to it, that Jacobs had quite a number of horses stabled, and nobody could get near the horses to water them. And McDonough ordered one or two of his men, with great danger to their own lives, to go out and release the horses. You know, just let the horses out and then they'd be looked after, you know. It was very humane. And he's very complimentary about that. You know, he's no time for the rebels, you know, so they're totally fantasists and all of this, you know. A couple of other things. Oh, yeah, there was a very amusing thing. Despite being told not to touch the machinery, one or two of the rebels, and they're boring them, I'm sure, and the ovens were still burning, because it would take a week or two for the ovens to go out. They tried their hand at biscuit making, and they burnt a couple of the biscuits. But years later, actually in 1966, 50 years later, there was a meeting of the Old Dublin Society, and they have these meetings once a year where members can bring in artefacts and show them to the other members. And this man brought in a little tin box, and there was this burnt carbonised thing inside it, and he explained that it was a biscuit that one of the rebels, who was a relation of his, maybe his father, I can't remember, had tried to make in Jacobs during Easter week 1916, and he took it home with him after the rest, so it still survived 50 years later. He also says that when the order came on the Saturday, I suppose it was, maybe Sunday, of the end of Easter week to surrender, they couldn't believe it. They didn't want it. They refused. They said, we're not going to surrender either. Because they didn't know the extent, you see, of what had happened to the GPO and all of that. You just didn't believe it. And some of them even rebelled against McDonough. Said, we're not going, you know, we're not going to surrender, you know.
Yeah.
We can win this, you know. And in their disgust, before they surrendered their rifles, some of them smashed them. Smashed their rifles before they handed them over, you know.
Yeah.
And also, the other thing was that, oh yeah, it was a couple of priests from probably Whitefriars Street nearby, I'm not sure, maybe it was from Whitefriars Street Church, and maybe some of the Capuchins, I'm not sure now, came along to negotiate it for safe passage for the rebels out. And so they were saying, well, we might be shot as we're walking out. So the priests assured them, look, that we have got it on board, or the British authorities, that you're safe, you know. And they said that the only damage was done, serious damage, was done when they left, and just before the British Army could manage to get in, the locals stormed the place and began to loot. And the priests had to warn them to stop, you know, and that was the only damage done, you know.
That's extraordinary.
So that was 1968 in Jacobs, yeah. You know, which is fascinating. Yeah.